Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. And a happy Father's Day to all the fathers among us. My name is Melissa Carvel-Zeemer, and it is my privilege to serve as the minister of this congregation. I'm joined in welcoming you this morning by Hal Walker, our music director, and Christina Spouty, who's serving as our worship associate this morning. Symbol of our free faith, sign of our courageous history, signifier of the promise of our liberal religious tradition. We gather this morning with hope that we can grow more deeply into the promise of a truly anti-racist, anti-oppressive, and multicultural Unitarian Universalism. May the light guide us as we endeavor to help shape the future we dream.
It's been hard to find words that seem appropriate for a call to worship for this service. In preparing with Melissa, I repeatedly found myself drawn to work and passages that I found edgy and challenging. I wanted to jump head-on into the deep reflections on anti-racism work and how to achieve change, as well as into the learning, celebrating, and honoring of the experiences of African Americans and other minority peoples who have contributed much to our faith. I want, for myself and all of us, to push harder and farther along the journey we've begun that will bring us closer to being multicultural, multiracial, and diverse as a congregation. I know that I personally have so much to learn, and this work just speaks to a fire that rages deep inside me. But I had to acknowledge that as a congregation, we may not be quite ready for that yet. Perhaps selfishly, I find myself wondering how much longer not only will I have to wait, but will this congregation have to wait? The change is hard and scary, I know all too well. However, through my own experiences, I've found that without change, there can't be real growth. I am excited about all the possibilities that will be open to us in this context and what a blessing it would be to this congregation and to the larger community we are part of. For today, my hope is that we can celebrate and appreciate the many obstacles and challenges that our African American forebears confronted with strength and determination, and out of love for us, that we might one day realize the vision of the beloved community that they dreamed about. Come, let us worship together.
During the school year, the children of the congregation join us every Sunday for a time for all ages. But in the summer, they have a special program that will keep them engaged for the whole duration of our service. The program this summer is a standalone program. Each Sunday stands alone. Themes from Dr. Seuss is the curriculum that they will be using. Our wisdom words this morning come from the Reverend David Eaton, who was the first African-American senior minister of a Unitarian Universalist congregation. He was called to All Souls Church in Washington, D.C. in 1969 and served there for 23 years. This is his poem, A Common Destiny. All living substance, all substance of energy and being and purpose are united and share the same destiny. All people, those we love and those we know not of, are united and share the same destiny. Birth to death, the unity we share with the sun, earth, our brothers and sisters, strangers, flowers of the field, snowflakes, volcanoes, and moonbeams. Birth, life, death, unknown, known, unknown. Our destiny, from unknown to unknown. I pray that we will know the awe and not fall into the pit of intellectual arrogance in attempting to explain it all away. The mystery can be our substance. May we have faith to accept this wonderful mystery and build upon its everlasting truth. With these words for meditation, we'll keep silence for a few moments together. We, for over a year, have tried to record significant joys, sorrows, and milestones that people share during this time in order to share them with the members of our caring ministries, and have found that we don't always know which items that people share they would like a response to, you would like a response to, and which items you're wanting witness to in this space, in this time with one another. So we have this book that we'll keep here every Sunday, and this will be our Joys, Sorrows, and Milestones book. So if you share something during the service that you would like brought to the attention of our Caring Ministries members, please come after the service or before the service and write it in the book, and we will respond to you. And everything else that is shared, we will hold together in witness with one another in this space. This morning, we celebrate with the Beale family, who are celebrating the arrival of Paxton Rex Beale on Wednesday. He and Danny are both doing well. And Elaine Bowen is celebrating the engagement of her nephew Nicholas to his beloved Sergio this past week. And I invite you to join together now in the spirit of prayer with this Father's Day prayer crafted by my colleague, the Reverend Christine Robinson. Today we pray for all the fathers. For all the fathers who drive kids to games and help with science projects and fix breakfasts, explain how babies are made and how baseball works, and read Richard Scarry and Goodnight Moon over and over again. This is for all the fathers who fight in wars, praying that victory will keep their children safe, and for the fathers who work a second job so their kids will be financially secure, and all the fathers who pay the bills and manage the accounts while their households sleep. This is for beleaguered fathers, and for happy fathers, rich fathers and poor fathers, healthy fathers and challenged fathers, for the fathers who made homes for the babies they fathered, who stayed married for their children's sake, and who stay in their kids' lives in spite of divorce. This is for the fathers who are excluded from their kids' lives, and the fathers who wish they had never been fathers, but don't forget that they are. And for those fathers whose much-wanted and much-cherished children bring them deep love and joy in their lives. This is for grandfathers who watch the kids while parents work, who tell their grandkids about the old days and teach them how to use a saw and make a kite out of newspaper. This is for boyfriends, stepfathers, foster fathers, and adoptive fathers who, without ties of biology, do the same. This is for the fathering men who faithfully, appropriately, and sometimes fearfully teach school, lead scout troops, sign up to be a big brother, or to coach a team. And this is for the men who wanted to be fathers and never were. This is for the fathers whose children have lost their way and won't call home, whose kids can't hear the wisdom or the love or the anguish. And for the fathers who could never find the words to say how proud they were of their kids who did okay, and for the fathers who did find those words and said them loud and clear. This is for all the fathers who teach their sons to cook and vacuum and their daughters to sink a jump shot and change a tire, and who teach their sons to respect women and their daughters that they can expect to be respected by men. This is for young fathers stumbling through diaper changes and sleep. This is for all the fathers. May they all be blessed. Amen.
This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings, and round me rings the music of the spheres. This is my Father's world. I rest me in the thought of rocks and trees, of skies and seas, His hand the wonders wrought. This is my Father's world. The birds their carols raise, the morning light, the lily white, declare their Maker's praise. This is my Father's world. He sings in all that's fair. In the rustling grass, I hear him pass. He speaks to me everywhere.
After 30 years of co-ministry with his wife, the Reverend Dr. Donna Morrison Reed, the Reverend Mark Morrison Reed is now retired from full-time parish ministry. He spends his time researching, writing, and traveling to Unitarian Universalist congregations, speaking these days about his new book, In Between, Memoirs of an Integration Baby. The story I want to tell you today comes from his first book, though, Black Pioneers in a White Denomination, a copy of which we have in the church's library. That book grew out of his theological school master's thesis. In the preface, he writes, "I am a black-born Unitarian bread minister of the liberal faith. I am an anomaly." His book seeks to explore the history of African Americans and Unitarianism and Universalism through a study of ministerial leadership. Morrison Reed's scholarship was both personal and academic, for he himself was only the 18th African American ever to be ordained by Unitarians, Universalists, or Unitarian Universalists. The first and second, Joseph Jordan and Thomas Wise, were ordained by the Universalist Church of America at the end of the 19th century. Those two men served fairly brief Universalist settlements in Norfolk and Suffolk, Virginia. The third African American ordained by the Universalists was Joseph Fletcher Jordan, no relation to Joseph Jordan, who is pictured on the cover of your order of service. An ordained Baptist minister, Jordan was so deeply impacted by a book on Universalism that a colleague gave him that he concluded he could no longer preach the Baptist faith. He found an experienced Universalist minister in Philadelphia to mentor him and spent several months in study and reflection. At the end of that time, he formally requested his ordination be transferred to the Universalist denomination. He followed his predecessors in serving the Universalist settlements in Norfolk and Suffolk, Virginia, for nearly 30 years. In addition to leading worship services in the heart of the black community, Jordan published a monthly paper called The Colored Universalist, and he organized a school in the church building for educationally denied black children during the week. Jordan believed that church and education went hand in hand to help people live life with dignity, purpose, and effectiveness, and to empower them in their community. He and his assistants taught hundreds of children in the day school, which remained strong even as the congregation declined in membership. Part of the struggle in maintaining a black Universalist congregation, as Morrison Reed sees it, was theological in nature. Many African Americans at the time were still deeply wounded, suffering from the trials and injustices of slavery, and were drawn to a theology that emphasized divine justice rather than universal salvation. But some African Americans did resonate with the Universalist message, and the problem for them was contending with the racism of a predominantly white denomination. The theological obstacles were different for African Americans drawn to Unitarianism, but the racism they encountered was even more overt. Egbert Ethelred Brown was the fourth African American ordained in our religious history and the first ordained by the Unitarians in the early 20th century. He was born in Jamaica and raised an Episcopalian. He tells the story of being in church one Sunday morning, a choir boy in the Montego Bay Episcopal Church, when reciting the Athanasian Creed, it suddenly occurred to him that he didn't believe what he was saying. That same day, he happened to visit his uncle, who happened to have a copy of a sermon by William Ellery Channing on his kitchen table. Brown inquired, the title caught his attention, God is One, took it home, and decided after reading that one sermon that he was a Unitarian. Some years later, he was employed as the organist in a Methodist church, and he began to discern a call to ministry. At the time, the African Methodist Episcopal Church of America was recruiting candidates in Jamaica and invited him to apply for admission into the ministry of that church. This was easy. They came to him. So Brown submitted his application. But immediately after he did so, he began having second thoughts. So he wrote a letter seeking information about how to enter the Unitarian ministry, And since he didn't know where to send it, he addressed it to any Unitarian minister serving in New York City. Remarkably, it made its way to a Unitarian minister serving in New York City who forwarded it to the president of Meadville Theological School, which was in Meadville, Pennsylvania at the time. The same day that Brown received a letter of acceptance from the AME Church, he also received a reply from Meadville informing him that he could come study at the theological school. However, the letter continued, as there are no Unitarian churches in America for colored people, and as white Unitarians require a white minister, there's no way to be sure that he could be guaranteed work when he finished his theological school training. Of his response, Brown writes, "The issue was clear. The conflict was short but sharp. I decided that I was not compelled to be a minister of religion at all. But if I did enter the ministry, I was under moral and spiritual compulsion to be a minister only of that church in which I could be absolutely honest." So he declined his acceptance into the ministry of the AME Church and began preparing to study for the Unitarian ministry. It took him 3 years to make it from Jamaica to Meadville, Pennsylvania. The first year he sailed to the United States, immigration officials refused to recognize the accounting position that he had arranged for himself as summer employment before school started and deported him back to Jamaica. The second year, his father, who had promised to pay his passage, was persuaded by some friends at the last minute not to let him leave and withdrew his offer of financial support. So the ship that was supposed to take him to Meadville the second year instead took a letter to the president of Meadville saying that he would be delayed one more year. And he decided he was going to do this on his own. So he saved up that year, earned the money, and the third year finally succeeded in making it to the United States, where he entered Meadville as a special student. His experience there, he remembers, is quite positive. But when he finished his preparation and returned to Jamaica to start a Unitarian mission, things were not quite as positive. He started in Montego Bay, his hometown. Unitarian officials sent someone after the first couple of years to assess his progress. The report reflected the same ambivalence about his prospects that he had originally encountered with leaders from the theological school. The assessor from the Unitarian Association affirmed Brown's good character and assessed that there were people in the region interested to hear a Unitarian message. At the same time, he argued that the prospects for a Unitarian church in the region were not especially good. He closed by suggesting that any financial donations to the effort might be encouraged under the auspices of social uplift for the Jamaican people rather than as religious mission work. Brown was undeterred. He focused on the positive elements of the report. It seemed he had a character that allowed him to do this, to really focus on the positive. And he decided that perhaps if he had a larger audience, he'd have more success. So he moved his church building mission to the larger city of Kingston, Jamaica. But Brown did not find the success in Kingston that he hoped for either, which he attributed in part to inconsistent support from leaders of the Unitarian denomination. After 3 years, they chose to eliminate his grant funding. In communications amongst themselves, American Unitarian leaders admitted that they weren't really sure that blacks were capable of grasping a Unitarian point of view. In one such communication, Lewis Cornish, who was the secretary of the American Unitarian Association, wrote, "I am told that Brown shows the emotional temperament of his race and perhaps a weakness of judgment. I have lived among Negroes and am inclined to be very sympathetic with their temperamental peculiarities," he continued. "They are very lovable people and often very childlike. It would be at once unjust and misleading to judge Mr. Brown as you would an Anglo-Saxon." Cornish's statement in that letter reveals both the racism and the paternalism with which Brown had to contend. If he knew that the support that he received from the Unitarian headquarters came out of a sense of noblesse oblige, he didn't let that hamper his efforts. Once he determined that the congregation in Kingston wasn't going anywhere anytime soon, Brown decided to move his family to America, to Harlem, New York. Brown arrived in Harlem at the height of the Harlem Renaissance. He founded the Harlem Unitarian Community Church, which was later renamed the Harlem Unitarian Church. Brown may have hoped that he would be able to leverage more support from the American Unitarian Association for a church in America, but that was not the case. He had to work full-time in other employment in order to support his family. And due to the high rates of unemployment and underemployment facing all people, but especially Black Americans at the time, he couldn't find work as an accountant, so he took whatever jobs he could get. As an elevator operator, as a speaker for the Socialist Party at their gatherings, and then as a secretary in the office of a magazine. The rest of his time he devoted to his small congregation in Harlem. Unitarian officials justified their denial of funds of support in part on the fact that the members of Brown's congregation did not make significant financial contributions to the ministry. Brown tried to explain to the Unitarian officials the financial constraints that African Americans were facing because of the racism which severely limited their job prospects, but the Unitarian leaders were not to be dissuaded. Entrepreneurial as he was, Brown decided to write directly to neighboring Unitarian congregations and ministers soliciting support. Unitarian leaders did not approve of that tactic and responded to by trying to have him removed from ministerial fellowship on three different occasions. Brown fought their efforts and was able to preserve his fellowship and continue leading his fledgling congregation long enough to see a change of leadership in the American Unitarian Association and a change of attitude in the larger society. The new leaders had more enlightened racial attitudes, and in the very last years of his ministry, Brown finally received both the moral and financial support he had long sought. It took him his whole career. Officials and clergy from the denomination turned out to help him celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Harlem Unitarian Church, and when he turned 65, he was able to retire on a minister's pension supported by the American Unitarian Association. The tragic news of this story is that the cost for progress was so very high. Brown, his wife, and his six children all struggled with the financial and psychological impacts of the racism Brown faced in his service to Unitarianism. The good news of this story is that Brown ended his ministerial career knowing that some in the denomination valued his efforts and that things were changing. At least one of his children lived long enough to have Mark Morrison Reed interview her for his book. At the end of her life, I hope she was able to take some measure of comfort from knowing that we are trying to learn from her father's experience and to live more fully into her father's dream. As an association, we have grown and changed. We made a commitment at the 1997 General Assembly to begin a new journey. The delegates to that General Assembly resolved that the Unitarian Universalist Association, its congregations, and affiliated organizations develop a comprehensive process to institutionalize anti-racism and multiculturalism, understanding that whether or not a group becomes multiracial, there's always the possibility of becoming anti-racist. We have called that journey a journey toward wholeness. The first adult religious education I ever took in a Unitarian Universalist congregation was named after this effort. Since then, I have participated in numerous workshops, classes, conversations, exploring what it means to be anti-racist, anti-oppressive, and multicultural. My life is better, richer, and more whole because I have been a part of this journey. Unitarian Universalism is richer, better, and more whole because we have been a part of this journey. And still, we have lots of room left to grow. Though we've been striving in this direction intentionally with conscious, deliberate effort for many years, we currently have fewer than 40 ministers of color or Latino, Latina, Hispanic, or multiracial ministers serving our congregations and another 20 or so serving in community ministries. There are about 50 Latino, Latina, Hispanic, multiracial, and people of color preparing for ministry in our seminaries at the moment. During a similar time of intentional effort, we have moved from having a predominantly male professional ministry to a majority female professional ministry today. Why have we made so much progress in one realm and not in another? The answers to that question are multiple and varied and have to do with larger societal dynamics, the persistence of our historical liturgical traditions, and dominant cultural norms in our congregations, among others. Recognizing that a multicultural Unitarian Universalism requires a multicultural Unitarian Universalist ministry, the UUA, Unitarian Universalist Association, has created the Diversity of Ministry Initiative. This comprehensive plan includes actively supporting the creation of new ministries by working to prepare ministers and congregations for multicultural ministry. It also includes supporting existing multicultural ministries and people of color, Latino, Latina, Hispanic, and multiracial people preparing for ministry. And in case you're wondering why I keep saying such a long mouthful, it's because some Latino, Latina, and Hispanic people and multiracial people don't prefer the reference people of color to identify themselves. And so in order to be respectful and to be anti-oppressive, we've learned that we need to use the language that people use to refer to themselves. Sociologists who study multiracial and multicultural congregations in the United States have learned a lot about what it takes to create and sustain those congregations. Multicultural ministry is part of it. Unless you think that smaller congregations like ours have no hope of participating in that movement, we can think about and be inspired by the model that West Shore Unitarian Universalist Congregation is following. They have a very significant commitment to this journey in their own congregation, and they decided that they wanted to participate in the diversity of ministry initiative through their interns. So they did a deliberate process for a couple of years to prepare the congregation to have an intern of color or a multiracial Latino, Latina, Hispanic intern serve their congregation. And this is something that they hope to continue doing, and perhaps something that we might aspire to one day as well. This is what we know. This journey doesn't happen by accident, and it will not happen passively. To grow into a multicultural, multiracial future takes effort, intention, commitment, and strategic thinking. It has to be central to the mission and the vision of the leaders and to require change. This is the journey that we are on. It isn't easy, but the benefits are nothing less than our collective wholeness. The face of the nation is changing. We've all heard that. People of color will soon be the majority. To remain relevant as a religious tradition, we must find a way to reflect the diversity of the nation. The face of the nation is changing. Our children are going to live in a different country than the one in which we were raised. For them, as much as for ourselves, we must learn to be the change that we hope to see. Amen, and blessed be. I send you with these words from Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Let us go remembering to praise, to live in the moment, to love mightily, to bow to the mystery. Go in peace.